Hi everyone, welcome back to the 21 and Sensory podcast with me, Emily. On today's episode, we are going to be hearing from some of the Sensory Street project team. So you might have heard in some of my previous podcasts that I am very excited about being part of the Sensory Street team. I have talked about it before, but if you have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about, I'm going to do a little bit of an introduction. So Sensory Street is a University of Oxford research project which explores the lives of autistic people with sensory processing difficulties, basically using creative and immersive experiences. So some of the questions that we're kind of asking at Sensory Street kind of go along the lines of, what does it mean to be an autistic person with sensory processing difficulties? How do sensory aspects of an environment impact autistic people? And how can we help people learn about what sensory processing difficulties are like? So it's a Wellcome Trust funded project, and it aims to work with the autistic community in creating an immersive event to help people learn more about sensory processing difficulties in a creative and interesting way. We're particularly interested in learning more about what sensory aspects of different public places, so places like shops, supermarkets, restaurants, hairdressers, most affect autistic people. During 2021, we posted a series of questions on our social media pages, which I'll link in the show notes if in case you want to follow us, and we ran a series of focus groups with autistic people to learn more about their sensory experiences. We then analysed the results of these and we wrote up our findings, which you can have a look at on our website, and we're going to use this information to help us create an immersive event in 2022. This year we're planning on working with autistic adults to support the creation of our immersive event, and we look forward to seeing as many people there as possible. So today I thought that I could kind of interview slash casually talk to a few members of the Sensory Street team. So before I do that, I just want to introduce the entire team, because obviously not everyone could, you know, fit in this podcast, and there are quite a few of us on the team. So I'm going to go through everyone now. So Dr. Kathy Manning is a lecturer at the School of Psychology and Clinical Language Sciences at the University of Reading. Her research focuses on the development of visual perception through childhood and how perception is altered in neurodevelopmental conditions. She's also a Wellcome Trust funded researcher at Oxford University, looking at how autistic children process visual information differently to children without autism. And then we have Becky, who you're going to hear from in a little bit. Becky is the founder of Sensory Spectacle. After studying a master's looking at the autistic sensory world, she began creating immersive learning environments to make better awareness of sensory processing disorder to society. So this is how Sensory Spectacle began educating about and creating awareness of sensory processing disorder. And then we have Catherine. She is a children's specialist speech and language therapist and research and engagement officer in the experimental psychology department at the University of Oxford. She loves combining her work with a love of amateur dramatics, having just completed a master's at UCL investigating how we can use theatre to increase people's understanding of stammering. And then you have me. I am on the project team as well, and you know all about me. This is my podcast, so I'm not going to reintroduce myself. And then we have Brett. Dr. Brett Heisman is a senior lecturer at the School of Education, Language and Psychology at York St. John University. His research interests include investigating enabling environments for autistic people through society, culture and technology. He also holds an MSc in Social and Public Communication, an MSc in English Language and an MA in Linguistics and Classical Studies. Prior to joining York St. John, he was a postdoctoral research associate at the Centre for Research in Autism and Education at UCL. And then we have Jess. Jess is an artist whose creative process is participatory, collaborative and inclusive, with a focus on disability and neurodiversity. Jess completed her Inclusive Arts Practice MA at the University of Brighton, where Jess and eight other participants curated the Neurodiversity Museum. She is the founder of Dyspraxic Me, which I'll link down below, which is a charity for dyspraxic young people and is experienced with supporting young people and works within museums. Jess was also awarded a place on the Shaw Trust Power 100 2018 list of the most influential and inspirational disabled people in Britain. Then we have Dr. Karen McLennan. Karen is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Reading, whose PhD research explored the links between sensory reactivity differences, intolerance of uncertainty and anxiety in autistic children and adults. She is also an experienced assistant clinical psychologist specialising in autism and mental health. Karen is passionate about improving mental health outcomes for autistic individuals and is an advocate for participatory research practices. So yeah, that's Karen. I'm going to link social media for everyone and obviously the Sensory Street website so you can find out a little bit more. And we also have Ravine. She is studying for a BSc in psychology at the University of Reading. And during her professional placement year, she is working as a research assistant for Cathy at the university. So yeah, that's our whole team. You'll hear me talk to Becky and Karen about how nice it is that we have such like a varied team in terms of people with academic and research backgrounds, but also obviously lived experience as well. So yeah, it's been a really like collaborative kind of team. So yeah, that's our team. I really recommend checking out our Sensory Street website if you want to find more about our findings from the focus groups and things along the way. Also, there's a little bit more about our social media on there and like an analysis of the posts and things we've done. And there's also like a section for updates and things like that. So if you are kind of keen to keep up to date with the project, you can check it out there. So yeah, let's dive straight into talking to Becky.
Hi, Becky. Thanks so much for coming on my podcast. It'd be great if you could do a little introduction to yourself and just tell my listeners a little bit more about you, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. So my name's Becky. I'm the founder of Sensory Spectacle. So we create immersive learning environments to help create a better awareness of sensory processing disorder. It's been running since 2014, but I've been doing it full time since 2016. So I used to work in a setting, a short break setting, and supported 0 to 19 year olds with various complex health needs, learning difficulties, additional needs. And within that job, we didn't really have much training to help us understand the sensory side of supporting those young people. And so I just took it upon myself to learn it. And so I studied a master's in art and science. And that's where I started to create these immersive learning environments. Ultimately, I want the public to understand sensory processing disorder better so that we can adapt environments, provide better support strategies, and just help everyone to feel more included in society.
Amazing. It's really interesting to hear a little bit more of your background, because obviously I've kind of known you since you were kind of full-time on like Sensory Spectacle, so it's nice to obviously know your experience, and it's nice to hear from someone who's really like advocating for people with like sensory processing issues. So yeah, it's nice to hear. And I was going to ask you, so obviously you introduced me to the Sensory Street project and kind of got me on board, but how were you kind of brought on board, and how did you sort of first kind of hear about the project?
So back in 2014, I had an exhibition in London. So it was after my master's. I wanted to put all of my works that I'd created during my master's on exhibition, and I was really kindly gifted a exhibition space for a whole month for free, which in London you just can't turn down. So I, when that was in set up in Southwark, lots of people obviously came to visit it, but I also had lots of inquiries from a whole range of different people. Brett Teesman, who's on this project as well, came to the exhibition because he was doing a PhD at the time in the perceptual understanding of sensory differences, but he's also a trustee for an autism charity. And one of the other contacts was Cathy, and Cathy was researching a PhD, but focusing on visual processing differences within autistic people. So her area of skill and expertise is within visual processing. And I had my Lola's World visual processing mirror on exhibition, and she just wanted to know more about that. And so since then, we'd had a few, you know, meetings and talking about projects and various things. And then it was a good few years later, she got in touch with me to say, I've been offered to apply for this funding through Wellcome. I want to create something where we can make better awareness of sensory processing differences. would you like to be involved? And obviously I said yes. And I had already in my mind wanted to create a sensory street for a long, long time. And so I shared with her my ideas, and we then formulated that into a proposal, and we got accepted, and that's where we are now.
Oh, amazing. It's really interesting to hear how you like came across these people, like obviously Kathy and Brett, and it's interesting that they were obviously kind of keeping an eye out as well in terms of, you know, exhibitions and things like that. And it's nice to hear that they kind of like organically came across like your work and stuff. That's quite interesting. Did you kind of, for your exhibition, did you kind of send invites to kind of universities and things, or do you think people just kind of, it was like a word of mouth kind of thing?
Yeah, not really.
Okay.
I think back then it was simply, it was really easy to get onto Time Out. Mm-hmm. So I had the advert in Time Out magazine. And no, I think all of the other emails were just people who had come across the work that I was doing or who I had been in touch with while I was doing my master's.
Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of people don't really realise that, like, with like kind of research projects and stuff like that, it is kind of like about who you know. You know, obviously I was introduced to it through you, and you were introduced to it through people that came to your exhibition. Like, it can be quite difficult to, you know, kind of break into the kind of academic side of things and research and stuff. So it's definitely, it's great that they actually like attended your exhibition, and amazing that you had it on for a month. That's cool.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it was really encouraging for me, especially I think when Brett came along, because he showed me that there is a real interest academically as well as creatively in trying to communicate just the sensory processing world, really.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's nice that they've kind of reached out to you and me potentially for like our own kind of experiences and stuff. And I know obviously you studied a master's, but like I'm not that academic, and it's nice that they want to include, like, I don't know, a real range of people who have like research background, experience background, you know, stuff like that. So I think it's what I'm trying to say is that it's a very varied project team, which I think is quite nice.
And we're, you know, we've all got our strengths, and I think that's where it's proven really good, I think, so far.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned about like a previous, like you mentioned about Lola's World. I don't know if you wanted to maybe explain like a couple of live experiences you've done. Obviously, I'll maybe link to your website, because I know you've got some really good images of like the experiences you've done before. But I know you did like a dining room one as well.
Yeah. So Lola's World is a visual processing difficulty, and it was based on a girl that I used to support. When she would come up and greet me, she found it difficult to give me eye contact. But when she was close to my face, it was almost like she was tilting her head from side to side and moving, you know, forwards and backwards, as though she was trying to really get her focus on me. Mm-hmm. And when I looked into this more, Temple Grandin, who I'm sure we all know, also described, and she's got a really great visual which links to Oliver Sacks's breakdown of a migraine, and she links that for some people with visual processing difficulties, they might be seeing the world in that fragmented way where they can see things, but it's just difficult to piece it together to formulate one picture. Mm-hmm. And so the girl that I was supporting, when she was tilting her head from side to side and moving it forwards and backwards, it kind of made me think, oh, maybe that's what she's trying to work out. She's trying to piece that, all that information together to see that one big picture. Mm-hmm. And so when you're standing in front of the mirror, you're seeing yourself fragmented and distorted, as though someone with a visual processing difficulty, or that particular visual processing difficulty, may be seeing as well. So it's really helped people to kind of step outside of themselves and think, you know what, maybe that's how they're seeing the world around them, and so maybe I should try and support them in this way. Mm-hmm. And then the sensory dining room is a whole immersive environment. So once I'd looked at a few of the individual senses and creating experiences to help people feel those, I wanted to kind of bring things together and really try and communicate a whole environment. So I worked with Queen's Mill School in London, and we created the sensory dining room. They wanted to do a project all about eating and mealtimes, and we worked together to interview their students, ask them questions about food and just mealtime environment, sensory-wise. And the sensory dining room is an eating experience where we provided training for the staff at Queen's Mill School to understand their students better. So they went into their dining hall, they went up to the service desk where they would collect their food, they selected three meals, and then they went back to the table where they would sit down and eat, which was what their students did every day. And the experience was all about, so environmentally, there were auditory, so there were sounds and experiences to emphasise how some of the students described it to be sounding like. There was visual differences, and then there was the differences within the food. So it was helping to create awareness of maybe the way that a food might look or way the food might taste, and how it can be any of our senses that can become involved when we're talking about eating. Hopefully then the staff went back into their setting and were, you know, thinking in a slightly different way of how they could then support those students once they had experienced it for themselves.
Mm-hmm. I love that you do, what like I really like about your work is that it's very like physical. Like, as much as I like appreciate like virtual exhibitions and things like that and through screens and stuff, yours is very like physical, like kind of Lola's World. It's all about kind of, it was like kind of like wearing it, wasn't it? Mm. The kind of like mirrored thing, yeah, from what I remember, or like seeing yourself in it, yeah, or like you're doing it actually like in an environment like a school, which I think is brilliant, because I think it's way more educational to actually, you know, maybe show like teachers and staff like actually this is what they're experiencing, and doing it in that environment is really important. So yeah, that's what I don't know, I think I'll definitely link to your website so people can see like more images, because I think it's hard to like explain it, but like I think it's good. Yeah
I think ever since I started, I wanted to focus on the reality of it. Mm-hmm. So sensory processing difficulties impact every aspect of someone's day. And if I was to provide a visual or an auditory experience, which was, you know, someone putting on some glasses or someone wearing some headphones, for that person who's getting that experience, psychologically, they know that they can take those headphones or those glasses off. Yeah. And it's then back to, you know, the way that they were seeing and hearing things before. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I'm putting you into a whole environment, your brain is telling you, oh, this is how someone might be feeling it, rather than, you know, the on-off switch that you might get from headphones and glasses.
Mm-hmm. It feels way more real to be put in the environment than it does to have, yeah, things added on, if that makes sense. Yeah, definitely. And I feel like that kind of really leads on to what we're kind of hoping to do within the like Sensory Street project, within the kind of live experience kind of side of things, because obviously we've done the focus groups, and I think I'll get Karen to talk a little bit more about those. But the kind of main event, if you like, is the kind of live experience that we're hopefully going to do in July, I think, this year. I don't know if you want to kind of talk a little bit more about that and kind of any thoughts that you have.
We, after the focus groups and all of the research was gathered, I was sent it, and it was almost kind of structured down into five main environments where we were having conversations with autistic people about where they found difficult to access. So the five environments that they kind of focused down onto were eateries, it was healthcare, so things like waiting rooms in particular, public transport, so that could be trains or buses or planes, supermarkets, and then kind of city centres or, you know, shopping centres. And so from those five environments, I was then sent so many insights and, you know, descriptions of what people found difficult or overwhelming or challenging within those spaces and those environments. But also we were able to have conversations about how we could possibly adapt those environments to make them more enabling, which, you know, is the ultimate aim of everything that we're doing. Yes, we want to create better awareness, but we also want people to know how they could change or adapt their environment in a realistic way. So, you know, not spending millions or thousands of pounds on changing something, but just being aware of some of the ways that we can adapt our environments to support different sensory needs. Mm-hmm. So the event in the summer in London is going to be focusing on thinking about giving an experience that might emphasize the disabling aspects within an environment, but also to demonstrate some of those enabling, so ways that we could then, you know, make that environment more pleasant for someone to experience.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting what you're saying about like making it an enabling environment, and also that really it can be something that isn't that expensive. It can be really inexpensive to just change up an environment and make it just slightly more accommodating for someone. And yeah. I think it'll be really interesting to see that in this live experience, in that it's just like, sometimes it's the little things, like maybe, I don't know, like the positioning of furniture, or like things to do with like input, like, I don't know, like the atmosphere, like the music, the, I don't know, even the just kind of background noise and stuff. Like sometimes it is just the little things that can make a really big difference.
I think it's quite easy for us to worry about, you know, everyone's sensory needs are so different. Mm-hmm. And so, oh, how are we going to support everyone's needs? And that can then stop people from wanting to try and adapt or make some changes, because they may, you know, feel that if they were to adapt the seating or the lighting for one, you know, person, would the other person benefit from that as well? And I think it's about showing that we are willing to learn and also understand what those difficulties might be. And from the research that we got, there are a lot of, you know, similarities in the things that people found overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And so I feel that we are able to demonstrate some of those enabling ways by, like you said, maybe adapting the seating or how the seating is positioned.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like it must have been really difficult, like after the focus groups, like for you to kind of whittle it down in terms of there are so many experiences you could have done, like there was so much information. I remember seeing it from the focus groups that, you know, there were so many potential like live like experiences that you could have done. Did you find that quite difficult to narrow down?
Yeah, definitely. And I think one of the most important things to focus on is that this experience is all about sensory processing differences. So there was lots and lots of, you know, insights and experiences which may have related to other difficulties. So maybe communication, or maybe more of a social anxiety. Mm-hmm. And we know that, you know, sensory processing differences can also lead to difficulties with social interaction and communication. However, we want to offer an experience which is giving an insight into, you know, what are those primary ways that people are finding difficult within an environment. So it took me a really long time to kind of filter through and also recognize that there's so many similarities, you know, people finding it difficult to process sound. So layering of sounds within an environment came up in pretty much all of the settings, so all of those five areas that we were looking at. So you know, being in a restaurant, people were talking about voices and music, but then also, you know, the crockery, the plates and the cutlery, the coffee machines, staff. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, you can visualize that for yourself. You can sit in a restaurant and think, you know what, there is lots going on within this space. How can we then, you know, make it more enjoyable for people who are going to be overwhelmed with all of that auditory information?
Mm-hmm. I think I forget as well that there is such a crossover, because I feel like for me, every environment feels totally different, but actually there are lots of similarities, like you say, between like, you know, like noise and stuff like that. And I feel like it's going to be really interesting for people who obviously, you know, might have, you know, processing difficulties, but also people that don't, just to kind of show them the reality of what every day can be like. And I think sometimes you just need to highlight these things, like, you know, imagine if, you know, you had all this kind of going on and put people in the shoes of people who do have like these sensory difficulties. And I think sometimes that's quite difficult, but with a live experience, hopefully you'll be able to really put them in the shoes of someone.
Yeah, I'm hoping so. And you know, even parents, I remember when I did the sensory classroom the first time, and that was at a big, you know, exhibitor fair, so there were loads of different types of people there. But when it was on the weekend, there were lots of autistic adults coming with their parents, and they wanted their parents to experience the classroom. They weren't in school anymore, but they wanted to help their parents understand what was it about school that they found so difficult. And so many of them found it really emotional, really overwhelming themselves, but also they were really proud of their child for being able to manage themselves within that environment to the extent that they did. So yeah, definitely the real kind of experience is going to be the most kind of powerful part to the public.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And I think like you say, like, I don't know, even just having like parents or carers with you. And I think it's really hard to get into your child's kind of mind. And how, like, I remember coming home from school and just not being able to like tell my parents everything that's wrong with an environment or wrong with a classroom. And actually, if you can take a parent to, you know, a classroom or something like that, or an experience, and be like, this is what it's like for me, I think that's really important, because it does just give them that kind of perspective. So yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting, this exhibition. And I don't know, I feel like we'll be able to get a lot from it in terms of I don't know, just being able to take like photos and videos as well, and being able to share it that way if people can't get to it and things like that. So
yes, I think that's the plan. We're gonna try and get a good you know, video representation created as well.
Yeah, that'll be good. And if you could just sort of tell us where people could find out more about you and where people can follow Sensory Spectacle, that would be great.
Yeah, sure. So I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. If you just search for Sensory Spectacle, you should find us there. Our logo is pink and orange, like fade, with an SS on top. Get in touch if you've got any questions. I'm always at the end of a message, or you can on our website contact us, so sensoryspectacle.co.uk. And we support people all over the world, so wherever you are, do get in touch and, you know, ask us your questions if you've got any, or you're struggling to maybe understand something or find the support that you require.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I'll also link the Sensory Street website, which I think it has like a kind of breakdown of everyone who's on the team and all the kind of focus group stuff as well. So if people are more interested in the project as well, I will link that. But yeah, thank you very much for coming on my podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Next up, we've got the lovely Keren. And I'm going to get her to introduce herself a little bit more and just tell us a little bit about her work and maybe a bit about her career and life. So, yeah, Keren, do you want to say hello?
Yes. Hi. Thanks for having me. Yeah, so I'm a I'm currently a postdoctoral researcher, but I'm generally an autism researcher. Mm-hmm. And I kind of mostly research things to do with sensory reactivity and also anxiety and autism, or in autistic individuals. And yeah, so I joined the team, the Sensory Street team, to help with the kind of research side of things after I finished my PhD.
How did you come across the Sensory Street project? Was it something that you like applied for?
Yeah, so well, I kind of had a connection with Kathy through kind of research reasons. Mm-hmm. She's worked with my PhD supervisor, Teresa Tavassoli, and I just happen to have quite specific skills, research skills to do with like kind of qualitative research, and I recently did a study kind of as part of my PhD that was looking at the sensory experiences of autistic people. Mm-hmm. So yeah, she was looking for somebody who had kind of very the kind of skills that I have, so she just kind of was putting feelers out for people, and yeah, it just happened to coincide really nicely for when I was finishing my PhD and I wasn't sure what I was going to do with myself, so I was like, this sounds amazing, and I was really excited, so I joined in.
Excellent. It's so interesting to hear how like people have like come on board, like from obviously Kathy starting it kind of thing and getting the like funding and stuff, because I was brought on board through like Becky, so it's interesting to like hear how everyone has like kind of known someone along the way.
Yeah.
And kind of everyone's skills. And I was saying like about, it's really nice that, I don't know, there's just like an amalgamation of different like experiences as well, like some academics, some like lived, and obviously like Becky with the like live experiences and stuff. So I feel like it's quite a nice team of like varied people, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been great to work on it for that reason, just because it's just been, I don't know, I feel like it's been a lovely collaboration with lots of different expertise. And yeah, it's been a really dynamic project to work on, which has been awesome.
I think like, especially when we were doing the focus groups, your skills were like obviously definitely needed, because it was such, I don't know, I didn't realize how like data driven it was and how like specific and detailed it gets. So
I think that's a funny thing in research, and something that I've really learned is, especially because like in my undergraduate it was such a focus on like numbers and like that kind of data, and like obviously like quite often qualitative research gets discounted as not being, you know, kind of rigorous and, you know, really strong research because it doesn't involve many people and numbers. But I think, yeah, from what I've kind of learned along the way now, is it's very, very, you know, there's a lot of kind of rules or like guidelines and things that you have to meet for it to be really kind of rigorous and like strong research. So once you start getting into that realm of qualitative research, you realize like that it is quite complex and there's a lot to it.
And even you like teaching us the software and stuff, and
yeah,
like how specific it was and how like you have to do things a certain way, otherwise it's just like not gonna accept it.
Oh,
kind of thing.
My gosh, I know. And there's so many different, because you know, I said to you at the beginning of it as well, like this is the way I kind of do it, and I know a lot of other people do it this way, but also I know loads of people who do it, I mean, everyone finds their own ways. And it's one of those, that's the lovely thing about qualitative work. You kind of evolve your own styles and your own kind of methods around those really specific methods. So I know people who literally print out all of the data and cut it all up and lay it all out on the table. And other people who obviously like, we did it like digitally. So yeah, there's so many. I always have to be like, are you sure you're happy doing it this way? There's other ways.
But yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot to learn.
It did definitely feel like a learning curve.
Yeah. You did a great job though.
Thanks.
It was so great having your input on that.
It was really nice to, I don't know, just do something kind of really different. But like you said, like we all came back and we'd all like, I don't know, in terms of like listing things or grouping things, we've done it so differently. And it's really interesting to see how, I don't know, other people's brains work in terms of like, you know, grouping sensory things or grouping environments and stuff. And we were like, oh, you've done it like this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one thing that I love about qualitative work is that, you know, the whole point is you're meant to be really, especially if you're doing like the reflexive work that we did, you have to be really, you almost have to, recognize your own lived experience and how that might lead to you have different interpretations, which is why I think that it was really strong the way we did it, because obviously we have you with your like, you know, lived experience in that, and then me with my research experience, and then, you know, bring that all together. So it's really, you know, I think it's almost better when you do have differences coming back with the results, because it means that all of those different experiences are all going to get kind of put into like, you know, deciding what the actual results are. And I think that's just, I love that way of working. I think it's great.
Yeah, it's a good way of like utilizing everyone as well, I think. And it is interesting, like, not to see what like bias, if that makes sense, but I think like you say, if you have like lived experience or like academic or research background, like you're drawing on that without like even realizing, which is wild to me.
Absolutely. And we had some really interesting discussions about like how we interpreted the different things in different ways, and there were obviously some things that like you picked up on that I completely missed because I don't have that like similar experience and stuff like that. So yeah, it's really fascinating way of like doing research, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe we could talk a little bit about like the focus groups that we kind of did. I say we, I just kind of help with the like
no, it's a full
bits,
we
but I know that you and like Kathy and Catherine, I think, were like all kind of doing the focus groups and like running the sessions and things. How was that?
mean, I always love doing focus groups or interviews or anything where people are really sharing their experiences with you. I just find that fascinating. Mm-hmm. I think you always learn so much. Like, even if obviously when it comes to, you know, you doing the rigorous analyses that you do afterwards, of in the moment when you're doing the focus groups, you're just listening to people, and like, you have to really actively listen as well, because you have to kind of, we don't have to, but the way we did it was asking, you know, follow-up questions and clarifying information and stuff. And I always find that, you know, because I think a lot of other research methods, you're so detached from the people that you're researching. Mm-hmm. You know, you can just put out an online survey and people can just tick some boxes and then they just become a number. I absolutely adore them. And I think that, you know, doing it online as well, it's the first time I'd done focus groups online, obviously because of the pandemic and everything. And it was just actually a really great method of getting people to a different range of people with different kind of strengths and differences to be able to communicate in a way that was comfortable for them as well, rather than, you know, the traditional way of getting everybody to travel somewhere and sit in a room and it's awkward. I think that for that reason, it was so lovely to hear everybody's. It's lovely. Obviously, it's hard for a lot of people, I think, you know, because it's not an easy subject when you're talking about, you know, things that you find really distressing to do with your environment. But I really appreciate hearing people's, you know, stories, basically.
Mm-hmm. And could you kind of explain, it's kind of tricky to sort of say, but like, what were we hoping to find out from the focus groups, and what have we kind of like learned from it? Because I find it hard to put into words, like obviously how helpful it is and how that's going to like play into the next like section of the project, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think I guess it, because this kind of, so sensory processing, I always say sensory reactivity, but yeah, sensory processing has always been, you know, a lot of the researchers kind of looked at it from a very personal perspective. So like, you know, especially traditionally when, you know, before the neurodiversity movement and stuff, it was always like, okay, what's wrong with this person? And let's look at that. Whereas obviously that, because of that, there's been a lot less research that's looked into the environmental impact. Like, it wasn't even, you know, there's a bit in the kind of built environment research, like looking at, you know, different ways that people interact with the environment, but actually in psychology there's very little looking at the environmental impact for people. So I guess, like, you know, using a focus group method to really kind of find out in depth what's happening for people and what their experiences are, we were able to, so the main aims were to kind of find out how autistic people experience their sensory environments, particularly related to public places, and to kind of find out what about those places make them particularly disabling, you know, rather than going, okay, the disability is the sensory processing. We were thinking, you know, people are, you know, with the kind of social model of disability, it's like people are only disabled due to their environment, or that's one of the factors. That it was kind of a really deep dive into working out why, you know, which environments were particularly disabling and why those environments are particularly disabling. Obviously, we asked as well about, you know, maybe more enjoyable situations and environments as well. But for this, the purpose was really to kind of, yeah, delve into finding out more about the disabling public places, with the aim of obviously trying to improve those places in the long run. So now we have that kind of really broad, deep information about these different places. We're able to kind of now come up with, you know, more focused experiments and hypotheses of things that we can, you know, do for further research to, you know, really start doing kind of more data-driven stuff, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And I think it was really interesting as well to see, like, from a kind of sensory point of view, like, there was obviously, like, a real crossover of, like, you know, the kind of sensory stuff that's going on in all these different environments. But then there was also, like, really specific things about, like, certain environments, like, I don't know, like waiting rooms or something like that, that like you know, we might not have necessarily picked up on, but someone else might have in the focus group kind of thing. And that was really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. You get a lot more of those nuances, mm-hmm. you know, especially because we did it from so many different, or kind of analysed it from so many different angles, because it was such a kind of, I guess, rich data set. Mm-hmm. you know, being able to go, okay, well, these are the broader things that are coming out that seem to be consistent across lots of environments. And then, yeah, also being able to kind of look at those case studies more specifically and go, yeah, like in hospitals, yeah. what is particularly challenging. And yeah, that's when you get those things like finding out more about waiting rooms and stuff. And, you know, that kind of research is invaluable, because it's, you know, you really then get so much in detail mm-hmm. about these different places.
And I was kind of talking to Becky about that as well, is that, I don't know, it must be really difficult, like being a researcher or like, you know, working in like an academic setting, because you have now all like so much information you get from this research, and there's only like, I don't know, one sort of avenue you can kind of go down with it, with like the funding that you have and the budget and stuff like that. And that must be really difficult, because there's so much you could do with all that data and all that like research that you've gathered, and you kind of learn so much for it, but there's only like so much you can do, I guess.
Yeah. Yes, that's very, very true. And I think like, yeah, it's always trying to find the right place and positioning for it. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, this kind of research, which is really involving the community you're researching, and, you know, having that kind of co-production happening.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, it's really powerful research that you, and because I think a lot of the, especially with the funding, mm-hmm. they mostly want you to say, oh, look, my study is going to cause change.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're researching something like this, it's really quite clear what the practical changes that can come from it are, you know, especially mm-hmm. for like policy and things like that. So, yeah, I think that's one really good thing for like this project. So hopefully it'll keep going.
Yeah. And I feel like also like there's so much that we could like, you know, put into papers or like present to like, you know, potential festivals, and also like on our website as well. I know like we've put all the like focus group stuff on there, so it is good that we can actually like share the learnings from it. It doesn't just like, you know, stay internal, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah, it's not just that in some academic journal behind all these paywalls,
yeah,
that nobody sees. But yeah, I think especially the way this kind of project was designed as well, is obviously wanting to kind of open up to everybody, anybody who benefit.
And I feel like especially the stuff on the website, which I know like Catherine's worked really hard to like word, I don't know, it just doesn't feel like too like tricky to read, or too like, you know, like heavy to sift through, like a journal might be, kind of thing. So I feel like it's a bit more accessible in terms of like research.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's so important, like research shouldn't be, especially when it's, you know, I mean, I guess there's, you know, it's really experimental studies sometimes that, you know, maybe don't involve certain groups of people. And, you know, I kind of get that they won't be of interest to everybody. But, you know, things like this, when it's really, you know, important to the population you're researching.
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, I think it's like any autism researchers, like, you know, they should be disseminating it and communicating it back to the community, so especially so you don't end up with research which isn't of importance to mm-hmm. the community either.
Yeah, exactly. And I think also, like, I don't know, I feel like our social media as well has been quite kind of like encouraging like conversation stuff mm-hmm. like that, and I feel people have been really like engaging with it as well, and that's quite nice to see, because I feel like, I don't know, I feel like it's not always like, I don't know, social media is kind of sometimes like an afterthought with research potentially, but
yeah,
I feel like absolutely. More and more projects, I know that you've worked on like Project Soothe, that has like a really good social media as well. And I feel like, I just feel like you're reaching like more people with it that way.
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. And I think it's so, I mean, yeah, it's so nice to be like, oh, I've done this thing. And I half the time I want to tell, public rather than the other researchers, because the other researchers are like, yeah, cool, next, because, you know, that's our job, we have to just move on and, you know, do the next piece of research. So the social media for this project has been like especially great, and it's been lovely to kind of see people engaging with it.
Yeah, it's nice just to get, like, I don't know, another kind of way of people feedbacking. And also, I don't know, I feel like we also used some of the kind of information that people have said through the social media posts as well. So we kind of learned from that, as well as, you know, it being engaging. So that's always a good thing.
Absolutely.
So, Karen, where can people follow you online? I'd just like everyone to promote themselves at the end.
Great. Yeah, I mean, mostly I talk about my research on Twitter, at Karen McLennan. But I also do talk about my research and my life on Instagram, at The Anxious Scientist. So yeah, those are the best places to find me.
Amazing. I will link those in the show notes for anyone that wants to go and follow you. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on and chatting about Sensory Street.
And thank you. I've loved working with you on this project.
Oh, thank you. It's been really nice to get to know more people as well.
Yeah.
Like networking as well, and getting to know like more people within, like, I don't know, academic stuff and research stuff is really interesting. So yeah, it's been really good.
Oh, great.
So next up, we've got the lovely Catherine, who I'm going to get her to introduce a little bit more about herself, but she's also part of the project team here on Sensory Street. So Catherine, do you want to say hi and introduce yourself?
Hi, yes. So obviously my name is Catherine, and my job in Sensory Street is I am a research assistant at the University of Oxford. In the rest of my working week, I'm also a specialist speech and language therapist here in Oxford. And I also do a bit of work with the British Stammering Association, also known as Stammer. So quite a lot of hats and a lot of very different jobs all at the same time.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It must be quite interesting to kind of like split your time across them. I know like you're always having to kind of like jump back into Sensory Street stuff, like as and when it kind of comes up and stuff. Do you find that you have to like juggle quite a lot?
Yeah, I think all three jobs are really interesting, but very different. So you have to kind of get used to jumping back and forth between lots of different job roles and ways of working, which is, yeah, can be challenging sometimes, but is also really fun. Like I do a lot of work with children, so I spend quite a lot of my time playing with pop-up pirates and you know, Jenga and all sorts of children's games. And then next I'll be working on, you know, making social media posts for Sensory Street, and then doing something with TikTok for teenagers on for stammering. So it's all, yeah, lots of very different things all the time, which is really fun.
It sounds like you're also like quite an organized person, because I remember like on one of our like Teams calls, you showed us like the notebooks you have for like each thing. I think that was you. At least I think that was you.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I think the best way to support my like kind of organization or brain is to have, yeah, one notebook that has each of the different things in it, so I can then keep going back to them and knowing that everything is all in one place rather than in three or four, five, six different books or places, which would not go very well for me.
That sounds like the best way of doing it.
Yeah, it's working so far, so that's a good start, I reckon.
That's good. And so how did you first hear about the Sensory Street project? Because I think I was on board by that point, and I don't know if I helped interview you. I think you might have done I might have done, yeah. It was a long time ago.
It was. Yeah, I think you were. I think it was you and Kathy and maybe Becky as well.
Okay.
So there was, yeah, quite a few people in the end, which was nice. But so I live in Oxford, and that's where some of my many jobs are based, which is nice. And I just finished doing a master's at UCL all about looking basically about whether we can challenge and change people's perceptions of stammering through the use of creative arts projects, in particular theatre. And I finished that in the September. And then I heard about this job role being advertised in kind of October, November time. And I thought it really fitted with all the stuff that I do kind of creatively. And it really fitted with a lot of the work that came from my master's, which was really exciting. So I heard about it through the University of Oxford jobs. They have a big kind of pool for researchers to look at different research projects that you might want to be involved in. And this one just, yeah, really jumped out at me. It's something that aligned really well not just with my speech and language therapy interests, but also that more creative side as well. So that was something I was really interested in.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that sounds interesting. So maybe we could chat about the like different stages of the project as such, because I know we've been working on it quite a while, and there's been lots of kind of different stages to get through in terms of, like, it'd be interesting to hear what your kind of main role has been, and like maybe you could talk about the social media posts you've done and things like that.
Yeah, definitely. So there's been quite a lot of very different stages of the project as it's progressed, which has been really interesting. So the kind of main focus for us last year was getting the opportunity to learn about what autistic people think of public spaces like supermarkets and restaurants and other different locations. And so the main focus for me was thinking about during COVID kind of how we could get those people kind of in one place and find out more about their views. So a lot of the work that I was doing last year was thinking about using social media and using kind of online focus groups to learn more about people's opinions. So I did a lot of work on creating many, many, many hundreds of Instagram posts and Twitter posts and all sorts of bits and pieces on social media, which has been really fun. I'm now very addicted to my use of Canva. So we did a lot of that to try and get people interested in the project, to help people learn a bit more about autism and learn a bit more about sensory processing. And then we recruited, I think it was 24 people in the end for 7 different focus groups. So we got the chance to really hear about lots of different perspectives. And what was really nice is we had people from all across the UK. So people from Scotland and Wales and England, and also a few people from much further away, like Germany. So it was really nice to get the chance to hear lots of different people's perspectives and opinions, which was really nice. Mm-hmm. And then once we kind of collected everybody's views, we wanted to analyze that and find out a bit more about what people have been saying and what kind of themes kept coming up and up again. So I worked alongside Kathy and Karen and yourself to look at all of the data that we've collected and try and look for patterns and themes. So kind of finding information that people kept saying over and over again. So once we collected all of that together, we put that into this sort of bank of different themes and sub-themes and collected all the information together. And we identified several different locations that people seemed to find more challenging than others. And we also found themes about what makes those locations more difficult. And we worked kind of really closely, particularly with Karen, about trying to collect those into sort of groups so that they felt like they made sense. And from that, we've got a research paper, which we've applied for the paper to be published in a journal, which hopefully will happen at some point this year. Mm-hmm. And we've also been involved in going to a conference where we shared some of that information a little bit more widely, which was really nice. And we've also been involved in going to a few different research panels as well, where we've talked a little bit about our research and then learnt more about what else is happening in the kind of autistic community, and also what's happening in the kind of research community as well in this sort of area and field. And so this year I'm still making many, many social media posts so that people can learn more about what the project's like and kind of what our findings were. And then we also did a little bit of work with some schools as well, so that we could, find out a bit more about children's perspectives. So we worked with a school to where they kind of hosted a discussion group in their school and gave us some information about what parents and teachers and other staff members reported about their children and the pupils that they work with. And then we've put all of that together on our website in a hopefully very comprehensive but accessible format.
Yeah, the website looks so good. Like I have mentioned it kind of previously in this podcast episode, but it really is the kind of like one-stop shop for like everything about the project, and I really like how you've laid it out. And I think I was saying to Karen as well, like how like easy it is to read, because I feel like a lot of research stuff can be really like hard to read because it's just so like, I don't know, not like academically worded, but there's lots of big words is what I'm trying to say. Whereas I feel like this is much more like accessible in terms of being able to actually understand what we were trying to do, which I think is really important. If, you know, say like me, you're autistic or something, and you're just trying to understand research, it can be quite like inaccessible. So yeah, the website's really good.
That's good. Because yeah, one of our big focuses was the fact that I was worried that we'd have all this data and we'd have a really fantastic research paper published in a journal somewhere, and then no one would actually be able to use it in real life, which kind of makes a lot of our research a bit pointless if it's all about helping autistic people and helping businesses learn how to make places more accessible. There's no point having that research and having that data if people can't actually use it. So the whole point of the website was to really make that as obvious and easy to read and as easy to understand as possible. So I'm glad that that's working.
Yeah, definitely. And like you say, like if businesses and, you know, schools and other like educators can access it as well, I think that's really important, because then it just makes the research go that little bit further than, like you say, like a journal or something like that, which, you know, not everyone has access to. So yeah, I think that is a good thing. So maybe we could chat a little bit about obviously the kind of like final live experience or kind of exhibition. Obviously like stuff isn't quite finalized yet, but if we could just kind of touch upon it a bit, that might be quite nice.
Yeah, definitely. So what we're hoping to do in mid to late July this year is do a public engagement project, which basically will be a place for us to create something a bit more immersive and a bit more multi-sensory, so that people can come to the experience, whether they have autism or if they don't have autism, and find out a bit more about autistic people's perspectives and their experiences in public spaces. So that could include, you know, for example, learning about some of the different themes that we found in our projects, which might include kind of sensory experiences, and might include some of the other things that we found as well, like time pressures or difficulties in being able to predict what a space will be like, or the difficulties with different size spaces, for example. At the moment, we're developing exactly what that is going to look like, but we're really hoping that it will, while it won't incorporate and encompass everything about, you know, how every autistic person experiences a space, because everyone is different and they all have different, you know, ways of seeing the world, like we all do. It should hopefully give us a way of being able to show an insight into some of the things that people could consider when they're designing public spaces, or whether they are a business, you know, building a restaurant or designing a supermarket. It should give people an idea of things that they should consider, or ways that they could, yeah, think about those spaces to make them more accessible and friendly. And yeah, we're hoping to do that in a really fun, fun multi-sensory way, which I think should be really exciting and something that, yeah, I'm really looking forward to creating in a couple of months' time. For my role in that, Becky gets to do all the fun design work. I have to just sit there and do lots of logistics. So it'll be lots of publicity and making flyers and posters and printing things and making sure things get from A to B, which is far less fun, but very valuable when you get to the end as well.
Oh, definitely. Definitely crucial to the entire thing working.
Yes. If things are still in place A instead of being in point B, it's often a problem. So it will be good once we get there. It just might take a little bit less time. A little bit less fun, but more time to get it right.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's going to be really exciting because, like you said, it's going to bring together a lot of like different people, not just kind of like academic and researchers, but also people who are autistic and have lived experience, or who are, you know, potentially carers or parents or educators. Like, I feel like it doesn't really matter who you are. Like, you might potentially get something from this experience and be able to see it from, you know, someone else's point of view, like just quite a overwhelming environment, for example. So I think it's going to be really interesting to have like a physical like kind of ending to the project, rather than just a kind of, you know, like I don't know, like article or journal or something like that. I think it's really nice to have something that people can actually come to.
Yeah, exactly. I think it'll be so nice to have, like you say, something that you can walk around and experience and really get more of an understanding, because it's easy to read things on paper and look at something and say, yes, that sounds terrible because of what somebody has written. And it is very different to stand somewhere and think, oh my gosh, I've realized how this must feel for somebody else, or why this would be difficult. And I think you really experience it in person in a very different way to how you do, yeah, written down on a piece of paper, or even seeing it on a screen, or listening to it in a podcast or, you know, radio episode or something. It's a really different experience.
And I think also it'll be good that we can, you know, obviously not everyone's going to be able to make it, but we can like document it as well, and hopefully like maybe share that via social media, so that everyone gets even just like a little bit of a flavor of how it went and what it was like. So hopefully we can share it that way as well.
Yeah, that's what I'm really hoping. We have already had a discussion with a videographer about recording some of the information and showing, being able to kind of share that then more widely once the program is finished. So I'm really looking forward to kind of, yeah, being able to have some stuff that we can take away and that people can be able to use long term and be able to look back on in the future, which I think will be really helpful.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see how it all turns out.
Yeah, me too. I can't wait for us to be able to get in the space and actually start doing the fun designing part. The logistics part is never quite as fun.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like we've talked about it so much. Like, I don't even know how long it's been since we started the project, like a couple of years, I feel. And obviously I feel like we've been very lucky considering like the pandemic and stuff, and being able to do all the like focus groups online and stuff. Like, we've still managed quite well considering, I think.
I think so.
Yeah, I think we've been quite lucky in some respect that we've just been able to, like you say, talk to so many different people and still kind of carry on, and hopefully it will all come together nicely at the end. I'm sure it will.
That is the plan. That is the plan. Yes, I have complete faith that it's going to all be fine. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing what the end result looks like, because I can visualize it a little bit, but I think there's still so many things that I'm just so intrigued to see what they'll look like in person. It's going to be really exciting.
And also, it'll be really nice to meet everyone else on the project team, because a lot of us haven't actually met in person. Like, I've never met you.
Yeah, that's true. We have a saying in one of my works, which is octopus legs, which is if you've only ever met somebody on a visual screen or on Zoom or on Teams, you have no idea whether they are in fact a real person or they have octopus legs. So
true.
I'm so excited to find out if you have real legs or in fact octopus legs. Both of which would be great.
Well, I will. I'm not going to give any spoilers as to.
I'll have to wait and see.
That's excellent. I like that. It's so true though, because like you only meet people from the top, like up, like from the shoulders up. It's really weird.
Yeah, it's, you never know how tall they're going to be until you meet them in person. They could be almost any height.
Exactly. I'm excited to see all the different sizes of people.
Yeah.
And where can people follow you if they want to kind of follow you online? I always feel like people should promote themselves at the end of a podcast.
Oh, yeah, that's very kind. So I am on Instagram, and then I'm also on Twitter. I'm at The Communicat. And yes, mostly active on Instagram, but occasionally post a few bits and pieces on Twitter as well. And you can find out more about me on both of those profiles and platforms, and then obviously specifically about the project through our Sensory Street account as well, which is unsurprisingly at Sensory Street. So you can get to find out a little bit about both of us on there.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Cool. I'll make sure to link your social media and obviously Sensory Street social media in the show notes below. But thank you so much for having a chat with me. It's really interesting to hear about how you like came on board as well. So hopefully I'll be able to do like another little update in the form of a podcast as to how the live experience went, maybe. So yeah, that'd be nice.
That'd be really exciting. And that means it'll also be a success, which is exactly what we're working for. So exactly. That is the plan on every level.
Oh, here's hoping. Thanks again for coming on.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.